Welcome to the PA Podcast. Hi, Tag here with my cohort BK, aka Father Brian, the great Steve Bluestein, comedian, author, TV scriptwriter. Jen and BK do an excellent interview with this amazing person. I was under the weather that night, so they rolled it for me.
Jenny took the lead on this interview since she's the one that set it up. Great job, Jenny. It was a pleasure talking to Steve about his new book, It's So Hard to Type with a Gun in My Mouth. Listen in with us to some stories from his life.
You know, I actually just got finished reading your book. You know, I finished
reading
it last night and just loved all your stories. You have so many just wonderful, wonderful stories, and not just about your Hollywood and entertainment, but just from your life, you know, and people you've known throughout your life.
Oh, yeah. No, there are some great stories in that book, Steve. I agree as well.
Oh, so good. You know, it's so funny because I just put it out there. It's just stuff that I've been talking about for years. So to me, it's not that funny anymore. But to people who are reading it for the first time, I guess it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's not only funny, but geez, I mean, you know, so positive in certain things. I mean, the working, you know, in retail at the Alexander's department store. And had a full family there, really, of just odd different people.
Well, but you know what? I'm still friendly with those people to this day. Rena McCrae, who's like 82 years old, who's an African-American lady. We send each other postcards to this day. I call her.
Oh, that is so wonderful.
Yeah, Steve Lee, he insisted that the local library in his town put my book in because we're still friends.
Oh, that's cool. That is so cool. Yeah, like you had your whole story there about Evelyn, which just, it brought me to tears. It was so sweet.
I know, and it's so true. And, you know, I can see those people in my head like it was yesterday, and it was 1969.
Wow.
And there's an Alexander's department store page on Facebook, and somebody wrote me and said, oh my God, I completely forgotten about the rows of time cards as you walked in to punch out. I brought back memories for them, which was really cool. And what's funny to me is that I never forgot any of this stuff. You know, because I had such a horrible childhood and it was very few positive memories, I hold on to every memory that I have that I find that's good, you know, and I've just held on to these for, you know, 30, 40 years.
And I think that is what makes your book just such a touching thing to read, that it really kind of just worms its way right into your heart, is because you did have this very violent, very difficult, horrible childhood. But then as you grow into a man, you surrounded yourself with really wonderful people and you find good in people.
Do you know what I say? I say that my friends are like jewels in a tiara. Each one of them individually are great, but together they are incredible. They make an incredible ensemble. And I have a lot of incredibly wonderful people, you know, the Morris and the Cherokeans and Lynn Turner and Lynn Mitchell. And, you know, these are people who I've just grown to love, you know, as a family. And how can I forget my Boston people, you know, the Marlene Bottolato and Marlene Demko. I have all my friends in twos, if you notice. Two Lynns and two Marlene.
Keep them paired. That's good.
Yeah, and two Steves. And I have, you know, strangely enough, I have very few comedian friends. I find it hard to remain friendly with them. But I have, you know, Kelly MacDonald and Kathy Ladman and Tom Frickman. These are all my comedian friends that I stay friendly with.
Yeah, and I know I've seen Kathy posts on your wall quite a bit, and I know you just think the world of her.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she, Steve Altman, and I went on the road together, and I hate going on the road. I detest it, but I went on the road with them, and we drove together. We started laughing the moment I got in the car, not because of me, you know, just because of them. And we didn't stop laughing for the entire week that we were there.
Oh, and I bet if we asked them, they would say, you know, that you kept them entertained and happy, because that sort of thing breeds into itself. You all play off of each other.
Yeah, and because we just love each other so much, and it's very rare that that happens. You know, I have a bad back. It goes into spasm, and I am literally crippled. And I carry with me on the road a back brace and medication. Well, I forgot to take it on this particular trip. And so I had a spasm in the hotel room, and I was on the floor in my hotel room, and the maid came in, saw me on the floor, and said, "I'll come back." You know, she just left me there on the floor.
Oh, jeez.
So I pulled the phone down off the dresser and called Kathy, and I said, "I'm crippled, I'm on the floor, and everybody knows about my back." And she went out and bought me a back brace and some medication. And
wow.
I still have that back brace today, but going home in the car, I took the medication, and it made me sleep. Now, unbeknownst to me, Kathy had bought a bathing suit and needed to return it. So when I woke up, we were in the parking lot of a shopping center. I thought we were back in L.A. So I got out of the car, I took my bags out, and I went into the mall looking for Kathy.
Oh, dear.
I couldn't find her because we were still in Vegas. So I went into the men's room, and I was so drugged from the medication that I went into the men's room and went to the bathroom and completely peed all over myself. So I was like, I had this huge wet stain in the front of my pants. So I couldn't go out because I was, you know, embarrassed. So I took my tank top that I was wearing and stretched it down to my knees. I went back out to the car, and Kathy and Steve were waiting for me. And they said, "Where the hell were you?" And I pick up my shirt, and Steve Altman laughed so hard he fell out of the car.
Oh,
you know, because I'm like Mr. Proper. And then Kathy started laughing, and then so the three of us just love each other. It's true.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it's great to have true friends like that. They'll always be there for you.
Well, it's great to have friends like that on the road.
Yeah.
Because usually when I'm on the road, it's with some psychopath who will say to me, you know, "I usually headline." And that is the worst thing a headliner can hear from the middle act. Is "I usually headline," because that means there's going to be resentment the entire week.
That, and you have an ego there that's maybe he thinks he ought to headline but doesn't.
Exactly right. And so just to be on the road with three headliners, because Steve and Kathy are both headliners, and so was I, to be on the road and have no egos and just have fun and laugh the whole time we're there, I mean, it's like a dream come true. But those are few and far between.
Now, you really don't go out on the road much at all anymore, do you?
No, I don't go out on the road very much anymore. I was on the road for almost 30 years. I couldn't take it anymore. You know, I just could not stand to be in another hotel room at another airport. You know, I used to come home and go, "Oh my God, look how big the soap is." You know, it was like, it was a horrible experience. And so I'm much happier now as a writer.
Sure.
I stay at home. I write my books. I write a column. And I write for a comic strip called Shoe, S-H-O-E.
Oh,
sure.
A great coincidence, because we have another gag writer that we are all friends with, Bill Linden, who also does gags for Shoe.
Oh, no kidding. I haven't met Bill, but I know of him.
Oh, yeah. He's a wonderful guy. He's somebody to get to know. He's so funny.
Yeah.
Oh, really? That's great. Yeah.
He knows how to enjoy life. Yeah.
Yeah, that man does not miss anything. He is very much a social butterfly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he actually ended up putting together a thing that he does in Chicago every year, where a bunch of people from Facebook that have never gotten to meet, they get together and they meet at the Bean, which is this one landmark there. It's a sculpture in Chicago. and they call it Beanapalooza.
Oh, what a great idea.
Yeah.
I would love to do that.
Yeah, he's a funny guy. It's just that's such a small world, you know, because that's not like a huge comic strip, you know. It's not like Garfield or anything like that, but it's one that's been around as long as I can remember.
Well, do you want to hear how I got the job?
Oh yeah.
I went to my high school reunion, and Susie McNally went to college with me, and we're sitting at the table, and I said, "What are you doing, Susie?" She said, "Well, my husband passed away, and I've taken over the comic strip." I said, "Oh, gee, that's great." And she said, "Yeah, but it's hard because I need gag writers." And I looked at her, and I said, "Hello." And I started the next day.
Oh,
that was
great.
5 years ago.
That's awesome.
So basically, great. you don't know whether or not your gag gets in until you see the paper, basically, right?
Exactly right.
That's got to be great.
I submit 42 gags a week.
Wow.
That is a lot of jokes to think up.
Well, you know, I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I sit down at the computer, and I knock out 7 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So, and I'm always, you know, all through the day, if something will come up, I'll write it down, and then I'll use it in the morning. It's really, it's a discipline, you know. I need the discipline to stay at the computer every day, so it's a great way to do it.
That's great. That is so awesome. Now, you've done, God, pretty much everything in Hollywood, I think. You've been a writer for shows.
And everyone.
You were a production coordinator for Surprise Gardener that was on HGTV.
Right.
And you have a great story about this, but you never, because I think it's because you're such a sweet person, you never name the person, you just call her bitch. And I love that. And then you ended up with two bitches.
Well, it wasn't that I'm so sweet, it's that I didn't want to get sued.
But
believe me, she was a bitch. And here's an interesting story. One night that I think it's in the book, we did a double shoot, and the runners had worked from like 6 o'clock in the morning all the way to midnight.
Oh yeah.
And they were exhausted. They're absolutely exhausted. And bitch called and said, "Send the runners back. I have a run for them." And I said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And we had a big fight because I refused to send them back. I wanted them to get some rest because she said to me, "They're young, they can handle it." I said, "No, they're going home." And there was a big to-do. Well, one of those runners is now one of the top directors at the Sci-Fi Channel and directs all these films and everything.
Oh,
and
really?
He's like, yeah, he's like hugely successful. And I get such great joy out of it. Because we both hate this bitch, and I keep teasing him about it. I said, "Remember, I saved your ass, so you have to get me a job."
Yeah, and that was, geez, you were like 20 years old when you did that, right?
No, when I was production coordinator?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't 20 years
old. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was probably in my 40s at that time, yeah.
My bad.
That's all right.
That's just because BK thinks everybody's 20.
Yeah, I
all
know.
The
well,
time,
I think
forever.
I think I'm 28, so it's...
Well, it is funny how age, you know, as you get older, it's like, well, I don't feel that old. You know, it's like, I'm 42, but I don't feel 42. I remember my parents at 42. I don't feel like that, you know. And maybe it's because I was never able to have kids, so I didn't have that, you know, that
marker.
Sort of, yeah.
That kids become the marker of how old you are, and they age you.
Yeah.
So no one should have children ever again.
They suck the life out of you.
They suck the life out of those little puppies.
Well, see, now my sister has kids, and that's fine because I can be the cool, fun aunt, and, you know... Whenever I have enough of them, it's just like, I'm out of here, you know, because they're teenagers
right.
Now, you know.
I'm out of here.
You know, and I just get the fun stuff and leave my sister to all the crap.
Do I have a cat? Yeah, I hear you have a cat in the background.
Oh, I thought that was your cat. I don't have a cat.
Well, my cat's here, but she's not making any noise. I do hear a cat on the phone, though.
Okay, I can't even hold my laughter. It's my cat. This is funny. This is Buddy the PA Podcast Kitty, and he's 18 years old, and he just speaks up whenever he damn well feels like it, because he's a...
I have Kitty Carlisle, and she's the meanest, most vicious cat that has ever lived in America. As a matter of fact, about 2 years ago, I fell and broke my two ribs and my neck at my house.
Yeah.
And the fire department came to take me to the hospital, and I was sitting in the foyer, and the fireman, this big guy, 6 foot guy with the rubber coat and the boots and the fireman's hat, and he's got a hook and a ladder and all that stuff. And he said to me, "Where are your keys?" I said, "Well, they're upstairs. They're go up these stairs, go into the kitchen. They're by the phone." So he goes up, and about 5 minutes later, he comes down and he says, "Your cat won't let me in the kitchen." That's a true story. And I said, "My cat has just jumped into the toilet." I swear to God to you, as I'm talking to you, the cat, I can see the bathroom, and she's just jumped into the toilet.
Oh,
maybe
God.
She's trying to commit suicide.
She's just getting a drink.
We're here with Steve Bluestein, and he's released his book, "It Is So Hard to Type with a Gun in My Mouth." And we're hearing a lot of great stories from that book, and I definitely recommend it.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and let's remind people they can get it at Amazon.com in hardback and on ebook. They can get it at Barnes & Noble for the Nook, and they can get it at Lulu in hardback. The only place you can't get it is on Sony e-reader, which is what one of us owns, so I had to get it on Kindle for PC.
Oh, really? But, if you have, like, an iPad, you can download the Kindle reader to your iPad and then send the book to your iPad. That's how I got it.
Well, I put Kindle for PC on my laptop, so that's how I ended up getting it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I just wanted to give you some shit because you forgot Sony.
Well, it's not that I forgot.
There's only so many. Yeah, available.
It's impossible. Nook, it took me a year to get on. A year!
Oh.
I mean, they put me through hell, and I've sold 3 books for that. What is the big deal? On Nook.
Yeah, just
I mean,
put
Amazon,
it on for crying out loud.
I know. Should we talk about the new patio furniture?
Yes,
oh, is that
yes.
Did it arrive?
What?
Did it arrive yet?
Oh, it came yesterday, and then it rained this morning.
Yeah, I saw the video last night, and it's so pretty. How disappointed are you with it?
I'm not disappointed with it at all. As a matter of fact, I ordered another piece. It's great.
You said it was going to be too big for your area.
I did. I thought it was going to be way too big because I didn't measure. I just saw it in the book and ordered it. But it's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. I posted a picture of it on Facebook. And by the way, I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter. And if anybody wants to be my friend, just friend me. I will friend Hitler if he asks. I mean, it's just how
That's
I am.
That's pretty forgiving for a Jewish man.
Oh yeah, I know, but I will. I don't hold the grudge.
Oh, you're very forgiving.
Very forgiving. I know. I will. I'll friend anybody. I'm easy. I'm so easy.
Yeah, okay, and yeah, let's remind people it's Steve Bluestein, not Steen. We will cut
not
you
Steen.
If you say Steen.
I will cut you and if you say Steen. It's Steein, right.
So I wanted you to talk about Maggie and her little incident with the ant traps.
And by the way, Maggie, Louie, Tori, Sully, they're all rescued. I get all my dogs at the pound, and they are the best dogs ever. But
oh, yeah.
Maggie was an English Springer Spaniel, and I was sitting at the pool at my house on July 3rd. I was just sitting down by a chaise, and I had a God shot. I sat up in the chair and said, "Go to the pound right now." So I got in my car. I went to the pound. Now, I always looked at the male dog, but this day I walked in and turned to the right and looked to the female dogs, and the first dog I saw was Maggie.
Hmm.
And I asked the girl, I didn't know the name at the time, I asked the girl at the pound, I said, "What's this dog's name?" And she said, "Maggie." And Maggie was the character that I wrote on 13 East, which was a sitcom on NBC, and I was one of the writers. And so I thought, well, it's meant to be. So I took Maggie home, and we were together for 14 years. But Maggie was a little mischievous, and she got into the garage, and she got into a box of ant traps. And I read the instructions, and it was like arsenic. And she had eaten these ant traps. And I was panic-stricken. So I had a new Lexus, brand new Lexus. And I threw the dog in the car, and I started running to the vet. And I hear Maggie in the back going, like that. And then all of a sudden, she like projectile vomits on the back of my head. She was in the back seat, and I was driving. And I let out this blood-curdling scream, you know, and I started to vomit myself. And so then the dog jumped into the front seat, and she vomited in the front seat. Then she jumped in the back, and she vomited in the back. And then she jumped in the front, and she vomited between the seats, you know, where the shift gets. I got to the vet's place, and I opened the car door, and the vomit just kind of poured out onto the sidewalk. And I was covered in vomit, and the nurse from the vet place comes out to meet me because I told her I was coming down, and she comes out and she goes, "Oh my God, don't come in the clinic." And so they took Maggie in, and they came, they gave me like a bucket and scrubs. They gave me clothes to change into. And we got it all cleaned up. The doctor said to me, I can't promise you that your dog will live through the night. And I was like, I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated. So sure enough, the next morning, the vet calls me and she said, "Your dog is a walking miracle. She's absolutely fine. She's up and happy, and come and get her." And so I got her, and I had her for, you know, 6 more years after that.
Ah, that's great.
Now, there is a great postscript to this whole story, but people are going to have to buy the book to find it, because that postscript is hysterical.
Yeah.
I'm glad you like it.
It was wonderful. It was just a great read.
Well, you know, being a stand-up all those years, I was very used to standing on stage, saying something, and then hearing an audience laugh. But with a book, you write it, and then you put it out there, and you never hear the laughter. So it's very hard for me to understand if the book is any good or not. The only way I know is if people tell me.
People have to give you those reviews and that feedback, because... Well, yeah, you don't know if they're in their house going, "Oh my God, this is great," or sometime. You never know.
Well, the interesting thing is I started a page on Facebook for "It's So Hard to Type with a Gun in My Mouth," and I have over 300 reviews of people telling me how they love the book. And then on Amazon, there are 28 5-star reviews. And out of 28, so 28 people gave reviews, 28 people gave it 5 stars.
Well, I have to jump on there, because I just recently finished it up, and I'll put on a 5-star review as well. I mean, it was just, I was a little late getting started on reading it, got a little worried, but I couldn't put it down.
Oh, that makes me feel so good, because people tell me that they laugh and then they cry, because I wrote it like a stream of consciousness. You know, I just...
It does feel like we're reading a journal, you know, just this really intimate portrait of your inner thoughts.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I started, you know, just... When I started writing, it was like, I have all these show business stories, you know, working with Barry Manilow, working with Donna Summer, working... with the Mills brothers, working with Kenny Loggins, you know, Frankie Valli, all these people that I work with, that I wanted to write down because I didn't want them to be forgotten. But then as I started writing the book, I started remembering stories like the New York stories and the stories about Emerson, where I went to college, and all these stories, and I just started throwing them in. And then as it started to morph into where I would start just telling stories that I swore that I would never share with another human being. You know, I just got them all out. I needed, and it became like a big AA inventory. I just began viewing all this stuff that I'd held inside for so many years, and it was so freeing to me to be able to tell those stories and get them out and see the reaction to them, because I had kept them hidden inside for all these years, and they take on a life of their own that may not be the truth. But once you get them out, and people start validating your feelings, then you see that, you know, you were right in how you felt.
Oh, so sure. And, yeah, you have some stories in there, especially about your mother, that I think I might have murdered her if she'd been mine. Because, I mean, that woman's insane. Now, is your mom still alive?
Oh, yeah. She can bench press 350, you know.
This woman was just toxic for you.
Well, the way I describe her is that she's a wonderful person. She's a horrible mother. You know, she just was one of these women who shouldn't have had children and had no idea what to do or how to be supportive or how to be, you know, she tries now, but, you know, the horse is out of the gate, or if you know what I mean. It's like, it's too late.
Sure.
But I just try to do the best I can, you know.
Coast to coast difference now, because isn't she in Florida?
Oh yeah, but you know, my joke is that if she moves one block west, I'm moving to Hawaii. Where in Florida are you?
Orlando area.
Oh, Orlando. Yeah,
he's in Orlando. I'm in Pennsylvania.
And I'm in San Diego.
No kidding. Well, boy, this is like a national show.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Great.
At least for the hosts.
Yeah, really.
Hey, Steve, maybe you can pass your mom's information on to Tag. I mean, he's single.
No. Oh, no.
I don't know him that well.
Okay.
I don't know him to hate him, you know.
Okay, hey, we're here with Steve Bluestein. His book is "It's So Hard to Type with a Gun in My Mouth." Hey, I have to ask you. You made a quick mention about your house being destroyed in the Northridge quake. Were you there?
No, I wasn't there during the. You know, it's very strange. I have these friends who have a home up in Lake Arrowhead, and they're like the closest thing to family that I have. Now, they have asked me to go up to their house in Arrowhead 30 times, but I have always refused because I felt that that's their place to get away, and I didn't want to impose. But this particular year, Wendy said, "Oh, come on, Steve, come up to the lake." And I said, okay, because my birthday is January 15th.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured we'd go up to the lake and celebrate my birthday. Well, the earthquake was the 17th. So I was in Lake Arrowhead when the earthquake happened, and the house in Lake Arrowhead shook violently.
Oh, yeah.
When we were up there. But it stopped, and we went back to sleep. The next morning when I woke up, I happened to see the news, and there was a shopping center, a Northridge shopping center, and it was completely destroyed. And I looked at Wendy, and I said, "Wendy, that's like a mile from my house." And I said, "I got to get home." And she said, "Look, if your house is destroyed, there's nothing you can do. So let's spend the day here and we'll get home leisurely." And I went, "Yeah, you're right."
Yeah.
And I had $138,000 damage.
Wow.
But I had earthquake insurance, so.
Oh, that's great. But yeah, it sounds like it was meant to be that she ended up going up that year up to Lake Arrowhead, which is beautiful, by the way. Been there.
Yeah, but you know what was interesting is that my dogs were in the kennel, my car was in Pasadena, and I was in Lake Arrowhead. So it may sound crazy to people, but I honestly believe that I have a guardian angel that takes care of me. And, you know, for all the years that I said, no, I'm not going up to Lake Arrowhead, this one time I said yes, and it was the time that was I was most protected.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
You know, reading your book, I think you've already named your guardian angel in the book. You wrote a poem that you put in your play, Gary's Gold.
Right.
That had me in tears last night. I mean, I just...
Really?
Oh, my God. It just touched me so much because this is just so loving. This was just the most beautiful poem. And I do think you named your guardian angel with that, and I think you named him well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to tell you that when you come from a family who was totally non-supportive, and really my career for my family has been like as unimportant an event as could possibly be. They're a bunch of very self-involved people. So I never had any exterior support from anyone. Gary was the first person in my life who said to me, "I believe in you. I will work for you. You owe me nothing." And wow. Then did what he said he was going to do. He was like my brother. I absolutely adored this man. He was my mentor. He was my muse. He taught me how to deal with real, you know, how to buy real estate. He taught me everything I know. He taught me. And when he died at 38, I absolutely fell apart and had to go into therapy, because not so much because I was worried about my career, but because I was devastated at the loss of someone who cared so much about me. Because I always felt nobody cared about me, and I learned that I was that's why I was grieving so desperately. And I grieved for 2 full years, 2 full years of like depression and crying, and you know. And then finally, a shrink said to me, "You know, Gary would not want you like this. He wouldn't want to see you suffering like this for so long." He said. And I had filled my house with, when they broke up Gary's house, his family said to me, "Just take whatever you want." And so I took Gary's clothes, and I took art, and I took things from his house because I wanted to have him around me, you know.
Yeah.
And I was wearing his clothes and stuff. And what it was doing is it stopping me from ending the grieving, because it was a constant reminder. So the shrink said, "Find one thing, keep the one thing, and give everything away. Give it all away." And that's exactly what I did, and the grieving stopped.
Yeah, it helped you. It helped you to move past that,
right,
that first step into getting to the other stages of grief.
Right. Yeah. And what I kept was Gary's briefcase, and I have it in my office, and whenever I have an important meeting, that's the briefcase that I carry.
Because you got Gary with you.
Because I carry it with him. I carry him with me.
Yeah.
And even though the initials on the briefcase are not mine, it's even better for me. It's like, I know he's there with me.
It's that protective layer, and that's wonderful. And, you know, I'm not gonna repeat the poem, because I will choke up again, but folks need to read this and to really feel this. You know, they need to get this book and read that poem, because it is so beautiful.
Touching, definitely.
And I wrote that poem the night that he died, because I was grieving so deeply. It was like I had to do something. I had to verbalize it, and I lived alone, and there was no one there to talk to. And so I sat down with a pencil and a paper, and I just wrote that poem from my heart. And I don't think you're the first person who's mentioned it, so that really makes me feel great that you liked it so much.
Oh, I definitely did. I mean, that was where I had to stop for a few minutes, because I was crying. I'm like, just caught me like right in my heart, you know. And especially because I know you suffer from panic and anxiety, and I do as well.
Yeah.
So I could definitely feel that, I think, a little more. You know, that just came from a place of so much loss.
Yeah, it was. It was. I suffer the loss of friends. You know, my friend Linda, who I also wrote about in the book.
Yes. That was another great story.
Yeah.
When she passed away, you know how sometimes you see in the theater they say, "John died," and then the person bursts into tears? And I was never that person. I would, "John died," and I'd go, "Oh, that's terrible." And when I got the phone call, "Linda died," I burst into tears, like I had never done in my life. This is somebody that I grew up with, you know, from maybe age 7 or 8 on. We were as close to family that you could have without being blood relatives. The most incredible thing happened that's not in the book, But 2 weeks after Linda died, I got a phone call from this woman, and she said, because she read my eulogy in the newspaper, because I wrote a eulogy for Linda, and she said, I want you to know that I think that we're related. And I said, we're related? And then I just went, oh my God, you're Linda's daughter. And I remember that Linda had given a daughter up for adoption when she was a young girl. And sure enough, it was Linda's daughter. And Linda's daughter found me 2 weeks after Linda passed away.
Wow.
And it was like having Linda all over again. She's a clone of her mother.
Wow.
And so that's when I think I wrote on Facebook that the children of the people that I love are like a gift with purchase. It's a little something extra you get, you know, and I love that. I love that my friend's kids are gifts with purchase.
Oh, that's awesome. I like the story that you had about you and Diana Bellamy working with, is it Scoey Mitchell?
Scoey Mitchell, yeah. That was the most insane time in my life. Because Diana owned a condo in the building that I had my first condo in, my first home. And she said to me, hey, Steve, Scoey is casting, and they're looking for writers. So I submitted a spec script to him, and I got hired. But Scoey didn't want the actors and the writers to mingle. So we couldn't let anybody know that we knew each other. About 3 weeks into the shoot, I go into Diana's dressing room, and we're sitting around talking. There's a knock on the door, and she says, who is it? And she says, it's Scoey. And I went, oh, my God. And she literally takes me and throws me into the bathroom and slams the door. And I'm in the bathroom with pressed up against the wall going, I'm invisible. I am invisible. I can leave this world right now. I am invisible. And in the other room, I hear Scoey saying, listen, Diana, I want to use your bathroom. And Diana's going, no, you can't use the bathroom. It's backed up. It stinks like shit in there. You can't go in. So she says, use the one down the hall. So she gets Scoey to leave. She opens the bathroom door. She grabs me by the collar, and she throws me out into the hallway and slams the door. We laughed about that for about 10 years afterwards.
Oh, yeah. That is funny. Hey, you know, do you have any other Scoey stories? Because, I mean, he sounds like quite a character.
Well, you know, Scoey Mitchell is he used to be a stand-up comedian, and he is notorious for his temper. And but I have in my heart a very soft spot for Scoey, because he was the man who put me in the very first television show I ever did. It was a pilot called
CIA Report.
The CIA Report, which was Comedy in America Report. And so he can do no wrong, because he's like a fan of mine. And because of that, he's on a pedestal. And no matter what he does, it's okay with me, because, he's got an extra space in my heart.
Yeah. Well, hey, in our talks, we've been going back and forth a little bit on Facebook. You know, you had brought up your fall that you had in your house. You broke a few ribs, and then I think you had to have a neck fusion, correct?
Right, exactly.
Doctor that you wanted to talk about that really helped you out finally?
Oh, yeah, well, Dr. Rudin, R-U-D-I-N, in Woodland Hills. But, you know, he says Rudin, and I said to him, come on, it's Rudin. What are you talking about? What is this Rudin? What, suddenly you're from France? Rudin. It's Rudin. Give me a break. He's just the best. You know, I'd gone to Cedars, and the doctor said, yeah, we'll make an incision here, and we'll do that, and we'll do this. And I said, well, can't we make the incision laterally so that we can hide it in a crease in my neck? And he said, don't worry about it. You'll still be cute when I'm done. And that was it for me, you know, because he wasn't listening to me. He didn't care about what I was talking about. He was, you know, it's like some of these doctors, they think that they're gods. And basically, they're not. So I actually went on Facebook and I said, I need a doctor. And the girl in New Jersey said, well, you should try my brother-in-law. So he said, here's his wife's phone number, call her. So I called this woman, this complete stranger. She was warm. She was wonderful. She told me, look, just you get, find a doctor and call me, tell me whose name it, I'll look him up, see how, what. So we kept communicating, and finally I said to her, well, why am I thinking about other doctors? Why don't I go to your husband? She said, well, if you want to, you just come on in. And I went in, and I met this guy, and he said, I met her husband, and he said to me, all right, we'll make the incision laterally. He said it to me. Which,
nice.
Yeah, which was immediately got my attention. But then I looked him up, and he had been Dean's List 4 years at UCLA. And then my one of my closest friends is Mike Cherukian, who's a very famous plastic surgeon. And Michael did some research, and he spoke to a bunch of anesthesiologists who worked with him, and they said his technique is magnificent. And then I sent a videotape to a friend of mine in Paris who is a surgeon, and he said to me, Steve, go to this guy. His technique is fantastic. So I went. I had been sleeping on the floor for 6 months in agony, nonstop, 24/7, on drugs for the pain for over a year. 4 days after the surgery, I stopped taking my pain medication.
Wow.
And in 7 days, I was sleeping in my bed again.
Nice. You know, that's the mark of a great surgeon.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, anytime you're having something so major done, particularly on your spine, you know, you got to get the best there is.
I was petrified. I was absolutely petrified. And the night before surgery, a friend of mine called and said, don't do it. I had the surgery and I can't feel my fingers now. You know, I don't want to hear that the night before my surgery.
Jeez. Yeah, there's a call you just don't want.
I don't want. But my friend Elaine Good came over. Elaine's a very famous chef out here in L.A. And she came over and she took my face in her hands and she said to me, look, you have to have this surgery. You have no life. You can't drive. You can't sleep. You can't even walk. You have to have the surgery. So go have it. Everything's going to be fine. And that's just what I needed to hear. And I did, and thank God everything's great. So Dr. Rudin, Brian Rudin, or Rudin, is like number one in my books.
Oh, great.
Great. That's a good recommendation from somebody who's been as patient, and you can get that word out there, and that's wonderful. Now, I wanted to ask you about, and I know we're running a little long here, I wanted to get your thoughts on reality TV, because you've talked about it on your Facebook.
Oh, I hate it.
I love you.
I hate it.
I love you, because I can't stand reality TV.
I hate
either.
It. It is, you know, first of all, there are real actors who have been trained, who have spent years in academies learning the craft of recreating an emotion and making you believe that they are the character that they're portraying, and then some bimbo from New Jersey makes $600,000 on a reality show, and I want to vomit. I think that reality is becoming the disco of the new millennium, because I think that people are starting to get tired of it. It's just garbage, and I hate it.
Yeah, it's sadly not becoming out of fashion quick enough for my liking. I mean, I don't even have cable anymore because I was just so sick of seeing that trash all the time.
Yeah, I mean, for Kim Kardashian to come out with a movie is nauseating to me. What has this woman done to warrant being starring in a film?
She starred in a film. Her own own film.
Oh, yeah, her own film. Yeah,
that didn't exactly require acting.
No.
Yeah, and that's the worst thing is about these reality, like, you know, the Jersey Shore especially, I mean, is that children are trying to emulate these freaking idiots. Well, I mean, they, and they're thinking that's the way you should act.
They market them towards young, impressionable teens or tweens, you know, and they get this kind of skewed idea of what's, you know, quote unquote cool or sexy, and it's atrocious.
Or reality, yeah.
Yeah, or reality, yeah.
The thing is, I believe, as you know, being in the entertainment industry, that we have a responsibility of raising the intelligent level of the audience, not bringing it down. And what's happened, you know, and I've seen this with stand-up comedy too. When I started in the 70s, comedy was a craft. We worked at it. Today, if you have a suit and a tie, you can become a comedian. And they're all talking about the same thing. They're all sounding exactly the same. It's all about your crotch. It's all dirty. And instead of bringing the intelligence of the audience up, they're sinking to the level of the audience. The comedians are sinking to the level of the audience. And it's the same thing with reality TV. They are bringing the intelligence of the audience down.
Yep.
Yeah, and sadly, I think it's just, it's so evident when you got, when you have teenagers graduating high school that can't read or write.
Meanwhile, China is putting out scientists and perfection and children that are perfectionists.
Yeah.
You know, while we're all talking about these stupid, unrelated issues like gay marriage, which should not even be an issue, you know, then
thank you.
They're putting out scientists, and we have a president who has tried everything in his power to bring this country into the next century, and a Congress that is stuck back in 1776. Don't get me started on those people.
Yeah, we usually try to stick away from politics just because it's such a hot button.
Well, hey, Steve, we can't thank you enough for your time. And your book.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Anytime you guys need me, just give me a call.
All right.
Take it easy.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks once again to Steve Bluestein for joining us on the PA Podcast to talk about his book, It's So Hard to Type with a Gun in My Mouth, available on Amazon.com, Lulu.com, and BarnesandNoble.com. Join us next time for an interview with Steve's good friend, Kathy Ladman. On behalf of Brian Tag Sontag, Father Brian Kilpatrick, and myself, I hope you have a great day.